This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. Written by Annie Jacobson. Read by the author. Dedication for Kevin. Prologue. This is a book about Nazi scientists and American government secrets. It is about how dark truths can be hidden from the public by U.S. officials in the name of national security. And it is about the unpredictable, often fortuitous circumstances through which truth gets revealed. Operation Paperclip was a post-war U.S. intelligence program that brought German scientists to America under secret military contracts. The program had a benign public face and a classified body of secrets and lies. "I'm mad on technology," Adolf Hitler told his inner circle at a dinner party in 1942. And in the aftermath of the German surrender, more than 1,600 of Hitler's technologists would become America's own. What follows puts a spotlight on 21 of these men. Under Operation Paperclip, which began in May of 1945, the scientists who helped the Third Reich wage war continued their weapons-related work for the U.S. government, developing rockets, chemical and biological weapons, aviation and space medicine for enhancing military pilot and astronaut performance, and many other armaments at a feverish and paranoid pace that came to define the Cold War. The age of weapons of mass destruction had begun, and with it came the treacherous concept of brinksmanship, the art of pursuing dangerous policy to the limits of safety before stopping. Hiring dedicated Nazis was without precedent, entirely unprincipled, and inherently dangerous, not just because, as Undersecretary of War Robert Patterson stated when debating if he should approve Paperclip, "these men are enemies," but because it was counter to democratic ideals. The men profiled in this book were not nominal Nazis. 8 of the 21, Otto Ambrose, Theodor Benziger, Kurt Blome, Walter Dornberger, Siegfried Knaemeyer, Walter Schreiber, Walter Schieber, and Wernher von Braun, each at some point worked side by side with Adolf Hitler, Heinrich Himmler, or Hermann Göring during the war. 15 of the 21 were dedicated members of the Nazi Party. 10 of them also joined the ultra-violent, ultra-nationalistic Nazi Party paramilitary squads, the SA, Sturmabteilung, or Stormtroopers, and the SS, Schutzstaffel, or Protection Squadron. 2 wore the Golden Party badge, indicating favor bestowed by the Führer. 1 was given an award of 1,000,000 Reichsmarks for scientific achievement. 6 of the 21 stood trial at Nuremberg. A 7th was released without trial under mysterious circumstances. And an 8th stood trial in Dachau for regional war crimes. 1 was convicted of mass murder and slavery, served some time in prison, was granted clemency, and then was hired by the U.S. Department of Energy. They came to America at the behest of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Some officials believed that by endorsing the Paperclip program, they were accepting the lesser of two evils, that if America didn't recruit these scientists, the Soviet communists surely would. Other generals and colonels respected and admired these men, and said so. To comprehend the impact of Operation Paperclip on American national security during the early days of the Cold War, and the legacy of warfighting technology it has left behind, it is important first to understand that the program was governed out of an office in the elite E-ring of the Pentagon. The Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency, JOA, was created solely and specifically to recruit and hire Nazi scientists and put them on weapons projects and in scientific intelligence programs within the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the CIA, starting in 1947, and other organizations. In some cases, when individual scientists had been too close to Hitler, the JOA hired them to work at U.S. military facilities in occupied Germany. The JOA was a subcommittee of the Joint Intelligence Committee, JIC, which provided national security information for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The JIC remains the least known and least studied U.S. intelligence agency of the 20th century. To understand the mindset of the Joint Intelligence Committee, consider this. Within 1 year of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the JIC warned the Joint Chiefs of Staff that the United States needed to prepare for total war with the Soviets, to include atomic, chemical, and biological warfare, and they even set an estimated start date of 1952. This book focuses on that uneasy period from 1945 to 1952, in which the JOA's recruitment of Nazi scientists was forever on the rise, culminating in accelerated paperclip, which allowed individuals previously deemed undesirable to be brought to the United States, including Major General Dr. Walter Schreiber, the Surgeon General of the Third Reich. Operation Paperclip left behind a legacy of ballistic missiles, sarin gas cluster bombs, underground bunkers, space capsules, and weaponized bubonic plague. It also left behind a trail of once-secret documents that I accessed to report this book, including post-war interrogation reports, Army intelligence security dossiers, Nazi Party paperwork, Allied intelligence armaments reports, declassified JOA memos, Nuremberg trial testimony, oral histories, a general's desk diaries, and a Nuremberg war crimes investigator's journal. Coupled with exclusive interviews and correspondence with children and grandchildren of these Nazi scientists, five of whom shared with me the personal papers and unpublished writings of their family members, what follows is the unsettling story of Operation Paperclip. All of the men profiled in this book are now dead. Enterprising achievers as they were, just as the majority of them won top military and science awards when they served the Third Reich, so it went that many of them won top U.S. military and civilian awards serving the United States. One had a U.S. government building named after him, and, as of 2013, two continue to have prestigious National Science Prizes given annually in their names. One invented the ear thermometer. Others helped man get to the moon. How did this happen, and what does this mean now? Does accomplishment cancel out past crimes? These are among the central questions in this dark and complicated tale. It is a story populated with Machiavellian connivers and men who dedicate their lives to designing weapons for the coming war. It is also a story about victory and what victory can often entail. It is rife with Nazis, many of whom were guilty of accessory to murder but were never charged and lived out their lives in prosperity in the United States. In the instances where a kind of justice is delivered, it rings of half measure. Or perhaps there is a hero in the record of fact, which continues to be filled in. Part 1. Only the dead have seen the end of war. Unknown. Chapter 1. The War and the Weapons. It was November 26, 1944, and Strasbourg, France, was still under attack. The cobblestone streets of this medieval city were in chaos. 3 days before, the 2nd French Armored Division had chased the Germans out of town and officially liberated the city from the Nazis. But now the Allies were having a difficult time holding the enemy back. German mortar rounds bombarded the streets. Air battles raged overhead, and in the center of town, inside a fancy apartment on Quai Clébard, armed U.S. soldiers guarded the Dutch-American particle physicist Samuel Goudsmit as he sat in an armchair scouring files. The apartment belonged to a German virus expert named Dr. Eugen Hagen, believed to be a key developer in the covert Nazi biological weapons program. Hagen had apparently fled his apartment in a hurry just a few days prior, leaving behind a framed photograph of Hitler on the mantel and a cache of important documents in the cabinets. Goudsmit and two colleagues, bacteriological warfare experts Bill Cromarty and Fred Wardenberg, had been reading over Dr. Hagen's documents for hours. Based on what was in front of them, they planned to be here all night. Most of Strasbourg was without electricity, so Goudsmit and his colleagues were reading by candlelight. Samuel Goudsmit led a unit engaged in a different kind of battle than the one being fought by the combat soldiers and airmen outside. Goudsmit and his team were on the hunt for Nazi science, German weaponry more advanced than what the Allies possessed. Goudsmit was scientific director of this top-secret mission, codename Operation Alsace, an esoteric and dangerous endeavor that was an offshoot of the Manhattan Project. Goudsmit and his colleagues were far more accustomed to working inside a laboratory than on a battlefield, and yet here they were, in the thick of the fight. It was up to these men of science to determine just how close the Third Reich was to waging atomic, biological, or chemical warfare against Allied troops. This was called ABC warfare by Alsace. An untold number of lives depended on the success of the operation. Samuel Goudsmit had qualities that made him the mission's ideal science director. Born in Holland, he spoke Dutch and German fluently. At age 23, he had become famous among fellow physicists for identifying the concept of electronic spin. 2 years later, he earned his PhD at the University of Leiden and moved to America to teach. During the war, Goudsmit worked on weapons development through a government-sponsored lab at MIT. This gave him unique insight into the clandestine world of atomic, biological, and chemical warfare, and had put him in this chair, reading quickly in the flickering candlelight. Just days before, Goudsmit's team had captured four of Hitler's top nuclear scientists and had learned from them that the Nazis' atomic bomb project had been a failure. This was an unexpected intelligence coup for Alsace and a huge relief. The focus now turned to the Reich's biological weapons program, rumored to be well advanced. Goudsmit and his team of Alsace agents knew that the University of Strasbourg had been doubling as a biological warfare research base for the Third Reich. Once a bastion of French academic prowess, this 400-year-old university had been taken over by the Reich Research Council, Hermann Göring's science organization, in 1941. Since then, the university had been transformed into a model outpost of Nazi science. Most of the university's professors had been replaced with men who were members of the Nazi Party and of Heinrich Himmler's SS. On this November night, Goudsmit made the decision to have his team set up camp in Professor Hagen's apartment and read all the documents in a straight shot. Alsace security team members set their guns aside, organized a meal of K-rations on the dining room table, and settled into a long night of cards. Goudsmit and the biological weapons experts Cromarty and Wardenberg sat back in Professor Hagen's easy chairs and worked on getting through all the files. Night fell and it began to snow, adding confusion to the scene outside. Hours passed. Then Goudsmit and Wardenberg let out a yell at the same moment, remembered Goudsmit, for we had both found papers that suddenly raised the curtain of secrecy for us. There in Professor Hagen's apartment, in apparently harmless communication, lay hidden a wealth of secret information available to anyone who understood it. Goudsmit was not deciphering code. The papers were not stamped top secret. They were just the usual gossip between colleagues, ordinary memos, Goudsmit recalled. But they were memos that were never meant to be found by American scientists. The plan was for the Third Reich to rule for 1,000 years. Of the 100 prisoners you sent me, Hagen wrote to a colleague at the university, an anatomist named Dr. August Hurt, 18 died in transport. Only 12 are in a condition suitable for my experiments. I therefore request that you send me another 100 prisoners, between 20 and 40 years of age, who are healthy and in a physical condition comparable to soldiers. Heil Hitler, Professor Dr. Eugen Hagen. The document was dated November 15, 1943. For Samuel Goudsmit, the moment was a stunning reveal. Here, casually tucked away in a group of Hagen's personal papers, he had discovered one of the most diabolical secrets of the Third Reich. Nazi doctors were conducting medical experiments on healthy humans. This was new information to the scientific community, but there was equally troubling information in the subtext of the letter as far as biological weapons were concerned. Hagen was a virus expert who specialized in creating vaccines. The fact that he was involved in human medical experiments made a kind of twisted sense to Goudsmit in a way that few others could interpret. In order to successfully unleash a biological weapon against an enemy force, the attacking army had to have already created its own vaccine against the deadly pathogen it intended to spread. This vaccine would act as the shield for its own soldiers and civilians. The biological weapon would act as the sword. The document Goudsmit was looking at was a little more than a year old. How much vaccine progress had the Nazis made since? As Goudsmit stared at the documents in front of him, he was faced with a troubling reality. Once, Eugen Hagen had been a temperate man, a physician dedicated to helping people. In 1932, Dr. Hagen had been awarded a prestigious fellowship by the Rockefeller Foundation in New York City, where he had helped to develop the world's first yellow fever vaccine. In 1937, he had been a contender for the Nobel Prize. Hagen had been one of Germany's leading men of medicine. Now, here he was testing deadly vaccines on once healthy prisoners from concentration camps supplied to him by Himmler's SS. If a leading doctor like Hagen had been able to conduct these kinds of research experiments with impunity, what else might be going on? Goudsmit and his colleagues scoured Dr. Hagen's papers, paying particular attention to the names of the doctors with whom Hagen corresponded about his prisoner shipments, his vaccine tests, and his future laboratory plans. Goudsmit started putting together a list of Nazi scientists who were now top priorities for Alsace to locate, capture, and interview. Dr. Eugen Hagen would never become a paperclip scientist. After the war, he would flee to the Soviet zone of occupation in Germany and work for the Russians. But among the names discovered in his apartment were two physicians important to Operation Paperclip. They were Dr. Kurt Blome, Deputy Surgeon General of the Third Reich, and Surgeon General Walter Scheiber. Dr. Blome was in charge of the Reich's biological weapons programs. Dr. Scheiber was in charge of its vaccines, the sword and the shield. Before Hitler rose to power, Blome and Scheiber had been internationally renowned physicians. Had Nazi science also made monsters of these men? Almost 2 weeks after the Alsace mission's discovery at Strasbourg, 300 miles to the north, in Germany, a party was underway. There, deep in the dark pine forests of Coesfeld, a magnificent, moated, 800-year-old stone castle called Varlar was being readied for a celebration. The castle was a medieval showpiece of the Munster region, resplendent with turrets, balustrades, and lookout towers. On this night, December 9th, 1944, the banquet hall had been decorated in full Nazi Party regalia. Trellises of ivy graced the podium. Flags featuring Germany's national eagle and swastika emblem hung from the walls, a motif repeated in each China Place setting where the guests of the Third Reich celebrated and dined. Outside, on Castle Varlar's grounds, the snow-covered fields were also being readied. For centuries, the castle had been a monastery, its broad lawns used as sacred spaces for Benedictine monks to stroll about and consider God. Now, in the frigid December cold, army technicians made last-minute adjustments to the metal platforms of portable rocket launch pads. On each sat a missile called the V-2. The giant V-2 rocket was the most advanced flying weapon ever created. It was 46 feet long, carried a warhead filled with up to 2,000 pounds of explosives in its nose cone, and could travel a distance of 190 miles at speeds up to 5 times the speed of sound. Its earlier version, the V-1 flying bomb, had been raining terror down on cities across northern Europe since the first one hit London on June 13, 1944. The V-2 rocket was faster and more fearsome. No Allied fighter aircraft could shoot down the V-2 from the sky, both because of the altitude at which it traveled and the speed of its descent. The specter of it crashing down into population centers, annihilating whoever or whatever happened to be there, was terrifying. The reverberations from each V-2 rocket explosion spread up to 20 miles, the Christian Science Monitor reported. The V-weapons bred fear. Since the start of the war, Hitler had boasted about fearsome, hitherto unknown, unique weapons that would render his enemies defenseless. Over time, and with the aid of propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, references to these mysterious weapons had been consolidated in a singular, terrifying catchphrase, Nazi wonder weapons, or Wunderwaffe. Now, throughout the summer and fall of 1944, the V-weapons made the threat a reality. That the Nazis had unfurled a wonder weapon of such power and potential this late in the war made many across Europe terrified about what else Hitler might have. Plans to evacuate 1 million civilians from London's city center were put in place, as British intelligence officers predicted that a next generation of V-weapons might carry deadly chemical or biological weapons in the nose cone. England issued 4.3 million gas masks to its city dwellers and told people to pray. Major General Walter Dornberger was the man in charge of the rocket programs for the German Army's weapons department. Dornberger was small, bald on top, and when he appeared in photographs alongside Himmler, he often wore a long, shin-length leather coat to match the Reichsfuhrer SS. He was a career soldier. This was his Second World War. He was also a talented engineer. Dornberger held 4 patents in rocket development and a degree in engineering from the Institute of Technology in Berlin. He was one of 4 honored guests at the Castle Varlar party. Later, he recalled the scene. Around the castle, in the dark forest, were the launching positions of V-2 troops in our operation against Antwerp. It had been Dornberger's idea to set up mobile launch pads, as opposed to firing V-2s from fortified bases in the Reich-controlled part of France. A wise idea, considering Allied forces had been pushing across the continent toward Germany since the Normandy landings in June. Antwerp was Belgium's bustling, northernmost port city, located just 137 miles away from the V-2 launch pads at Castle Varlar. For 1,000 years, it had been a strategic city in Western Europe, conquered and liberated more than 12 times. In this war, Belgium had suffered terrible losses under 4 long years of brutal Nazi rule. 3 months prior, on September 4, 1944, the Allies liberated Antwerp. There was joy in the streets when the British 11th Armored Division rolled into town. Since then, American and British forces had been relying heavily on the port of Antwerp to bring in men and materiel to support fighting on the Western Front, and also to prepare for the surge into Germany. Now, in the second week of December 1944, Hitler intended to reclaim Antwerp. The Führer and his inner circle were preparing to launch their last, still-secret counteroffensive in the Ardennes Forest, and for this, the German army needed Antwerp shut down. The job fell to the V2. The party at Castle Varlar was to be a night of warfare and celebration, with one 42,000-pound liquid-fueled rocket being fired off at the enemy after the next, while the guests honored four of the men who had been instrumental in building the wonder weapon for the Reich. The man at the scientific center of the V-2 rocket program was a 32-year-old aristocrat and wunderkind physicist named Werner von Braun. Von Braun was at Castle Varlar to receive, alongside Dornberger, one of Hitler's highest and most coveted non-combat decorations, the Knight's Cross of the War Service Cross. Also receiving the honor were Walter Riedel, the top scientist in the Rocket Design Bureau, and Heinz Kunz, a representative from the Reich's Armaments Ministry. These four medals were to be presented by Albert Speer, Hitler's Minister of Armaments and War Production. Armaments are the aggregate of a nation's military strength, and as Minister of Weapons, Speer was in charge of scientific armaments programs for the Third Reich. He joined the Nazi Party in 1931 at the age of 26 and rose to power in the party as Hitler's architect. In that role, he created buildings that symbolized the Reich and represented its ideas and quickly became a favorite, joining Hitler's inner circle. In February 1942, Hitler made Speer his Minister of Armaments and War Production after the former minister, Fritz Todt, died in a plane crash. By the following month, Speer had persuaded Hitler to make all other elements of the German economy second to armaments production, which Hitler did by decree. Total productivity in armaments increased by 59.6%, Speer claimed after the war. At the age of 37, Albert Speer was now responsible for all science and technology programs necessary for waging war. Of the hundreds of weapons projects he was involved in, it was the V-2 that he favored most. Like von Braun, Speer was from a wealthy, well-respected German family, not quite a baron, but someone who wished he was. Speer liked to exchange ideas with youthful, ambitious rocket scientists like Werner von Braun. He admired young men able to work unhampered by bureaucratic obstacles and pursue ideas which at times sounded thoroughly utopian. As for General Dornberger, the Castle Varlar celebration was a crowning moment of his career. The pomp and power thrilled him, he later recalled. It was a scene, Dornberger said, after the war, the excitement of the evening, the blackness of the night. At one point during the meal, in between courses, the lights inside the castle were turned off and the grand banquet hall was plunged into darkness. After a moment of anticipatory silence, a tall curtain at the end of the long hall swung open, allowing guests to gaze out across the dark, wintry lawns. The room suddenly lit up with the flickering light of the rocket's exhaust and was shaken by the reverberations of its engines, remembered Dornberger. Outside, perched atop a mobile rocket launch pad, the spectacle began. An inferno of burning rocket fuel blasted out the bottom of the V-2, powering the massive rocket into flight, headed toward Belgium. For Dornberger, rocket launches instilled unbelievable feelings of pride. Once, during an earlier launch, the general wept with joy. On this night, the excitement focus alternated. from a rocket launch to an award decoration, then back to a rocket launch again. After each launch, Speer decorated one of the medal recipients. The crowd clapped and cheered and sipped champagne until the banquet hall was again filled with darkness and the next rocket fired off the castle lawn. This particular party would end, but the celebrations continued elsewhere. The team returned to Peenemünde, the isolated island facility on the Baltic coast where the V-weapons had been conceived and originally produced. And on the night of December 16, 1944, a party in the Peenemünde's Officers' Club again honored the men. Von Braun and Dornberger, wearing crisp tuxedos, each with a Knight's Cross from Hitler dangling around his neck, read telegrams of congratulations to Nazi officials as the group toasted their success with flutes of champagne. In the eyes of the Reich, Hitler's rocketeers had good reason to celebrate. In Antwerp, at 3:20 p.m., a V-2 rocket had smashed into the Rex Cinema, where almost 1,200 people were watching a Gary Cooper film. It was the highest death toll from a single rocket attack during the war, 567 casualties. The Allies were obsessed with the Nazis' V-weapons. If they had been ready earlier, the course of the war could have been different, explained General Dwight D. Eisenhower, supreme Allied commander in Europe. It seemed likely that if the German had succeeded in perfecting and using these new weapons 6 months earlier than he did, our invasion of Europe would have proved exceedingly difficult, perhaps impossible, Eisenhower said. Instead, circumstance worked in the Allies' favor, and by the fall of 1944, Allied forces had a firm foothold on the European continent. But back in Washington, D.C., inside the Pentagon, a secret, U.S.-only, rocket-related scientific intelligence mission was in the works. Colonel Gervase William Trichell was the first chief of the newly created rocket branch inside U.S. Army Ordnance. Now, Trichell was putting together a group of Army scientists to send to Europe as part of Special Mission V-2. The United States was 20 years behind Germany in rocket development, but Trichell saw an opportunity to close that gap and save the U.S. Army millions of dollars in research and development costs. Trichell's team would capture these rockets and everything related to them for shipment back to the United States. The mission would begin as soon as the U.S. Army arrived in the town of Nordhausen, Germany. The British had the lead on intelligence regarding V-weapons. Their photo interpreters had determined exactly where the rockets were being assembled, at a factory in central Germany in the naturally fortified Harz Mountains. Trying to bomb this factory from the air was useless, because the facility had been built underground in an old gypsum mine. While the Americans made plans inside the Pentagon, and while von Braun and his colleagues drank champagne at Peenemünde, the men actually assembling the Reich's V-2 rockets endured an entirely different existence. Nazi science had brought back the institution of slavery all across the Reich, and concentration camp prisoners were being worked to death in the service of war. The workers building rockets included thousands of grotesquely malnourished prisoners who toiled away inside a sprawling underground tunnel complex known by its euphemism, Middlework, the Middle Works. This place was also called Nordhausen after the town, and Dora, the code name for its concentration camp. To average Germans, the Harz was a land of fairy tales, of dark forests and stormy mountains. To those who read Goethe, here was the place where the witches and the devil collided at Brocken Mountain. Even in America, in Disney's popular film Fantasia, these mountains had meaning. They were where forces of evil gathered to do their handiwork. But at the end of the Second World War, the Reich's secret, subterranean penal colony at Nordhausen was fact, not fiction. The Middlework was a place where ordinary citizens of France, Holland, Belgium, Italy, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Yugoslavia, Russia, Poland, and Germany had been transformed into the Third Reich's slaves. The underground factory at Nordhausen had been in operation since late August 1943, after a Royal Air Force attack on the Peenemünde facility up north forced armaments production to move elsewhere. The day after that attack, Heinrich Himmler, Reichsführer SS, paid a visit to Hitler and proposed they move rocket production underground. Hitler agreed, and the SS was put in charge of supplying slaves and overseeing facilities construction. The individual in charge of expanding Nordhausen from a mine to a tunnel complex was Brigadier General Hans Kammler, a civil engineer and architect who, earlier in his career, built the gas chambers at Auschwitz-Birkenau. The first group of 107 slave laborers arrived at the Middlework in late August 1943. They came from the Buchenwald concentration camp, located 50 miles to the southeast. The wrought iron sign over the Buchenwald gate read, "Jedem das Seine." Everyone gets what he deserves. Digging tunnels was hard labor, but the SS feared prisoners might revolt if they had mining tools, so the men dug with their bare hands. The old mine had been used by the German army as a fuel storage facility. There were two long tunnels running parallel into the mountain that needed to be widened now for rail cars. There were also smaller cross tunnels every few meters that needed to be lengthened to create more workspace. In September 1943, machinery and personnel arrived from Peenemünde. Notable among the staff, and important to Operation Paperclip, was the man in charge of production, a high school graduate named Arthur Rudolph. Rudolph's specialty was rocket engine assembly. He had worked under von Braun in this capacity since 1934. Rudolph was a Nazi ideologue. He joined the party before there was any national pressure to do so in 1931. What he lacked in academic pedigree, he made up for as a slave driver. As the Middlework operations director, Rudolph worked with the SS construction staff to build the underground facility. Then he oversaw production on the assembly lines for V-Weapons scientific director Werner von Braun. The prisoners worked 12-hour shifts, 7 days a week, putting together V-Weapons. By the end of the first 2 months, there were 8,000 men living and working in this cramped underground space. There was no fresh air in the tunnels, no ventilation system, no water, and very little light. Blasting went on day and night, and the dust after every blast was so thick that it was impossible to see 5 steps ahead, read one report. Laborers slept inside the tunnels on wood bunk beds. There were no washing facilities and no sanitation. Latrines were barrels cut in half. The workers suffered and died from starvation, dysentery, pleurisy, pneumonia, tuberculosis, and phlegmasia from beatings. The men were walking skeletons, skin stretched over bones. Some perished from ammonia burns to the lungs. Others died by being crushed from the weight of the rocket parts they were forced to carry. The dead were replaceable. Humans and machine parts went into the tunnels. Rockets and corpses came out. Workers who were slow on the production lines were beaten to death. Insubordinates were garroted or hanged. After the war, war crimes investigators determined that approximately half of the 60,000 men eventually brought to Nordhausen were worked to death. The Middlework wasn't the first slave labor camp created and run by the Third Reich. The SS recognized the value of slave labor in the mid-1930s. Humans could be selected from the ever-growing prisoner populations at concentration camps, and put to work in quarries and factories. By 1939, the SS had masterminded a vast network of state-sponsored slavery across Nazi-occupied Europe through an innocuous-sounding division called the SS Business Administration Main Office. This office was overseen by Heinrich Himmler, but required partnerships. These included many companies from the private sector, including IG Farben, Volkswagen, Heinkel, and Steyr Daimler Puch. The most significant partner was Albert Speer's Ministry of Armaments and War Production. When Speer took over as armaments minister in February 1942, his first challenge, he said, was to figure out how to galvanize war production and make it more efficient. Speer's solution was to get rid of bureaucracy and use more slave laborers. He himself had been connected to the slave labor programs with the SS for years, including when he was an architect. Speer's buildings required vast amounts of stone, which was quarried by concentration camp laborers from Mauthausen and Flossenbürg. The SS Business Administration Main Office specialized in engineering dangerous and fast construction projects, as was the case with the V2 facility at Nordhausen. "Pay no attention to the human victims," Brigadier General Hans Kammler told his staff overseeing construction in the tunnels. "The work must proceed and be finished in the shortest possible time." In the first 6 months of tunnel work, 2,882 laborers died. Albert Speer praised Kammler for what he considered to be a great achievement in engineering, setting things up so efficiently and so fast. "Your work far exceeds anything ever done in Europe and is unsurpassed even by American standards," wrote Speer. There were other reasons why the use of slave labor was so important to wonder weapons production, namely the secrecy it ensured. The V-2 was a classified weapons project. The less Allied intelligence knew about it, the better for the Reich. When Albert Speer and Heinrich Himmler met with Hitler in August of 1943 to brief him on the benefits of using slave labor, Himmler reminded the Führer that if the Reich's entire workforce were to be concentration camp prisoners, all contact with the outside world would be eliminated. Prisoners don't even receive mail. In the spring of 1944, V-2 production had accelerated to the point where the SS provided middlework managers with their own concentration camp, Dora, which in turn grew to include 30 subcamps. The man in charge of personnel at the middlework, its general manager, was a 46-year-old engineer named Georg Ricke, an ardent Nazi and party member since 1931. On Ricke's resume, later used by the Americans to employ him, Ricke described himself as middlework general manager, production of all V and rocket weapons, construction of underground mass production facilities, director of entire concern. As general manager of the sprawling subterranean enterprise, Ricke was in charge of renting slaves from the SS. As a former DMAG Armor Works executive, he had already overseen the creation of more than 1.5 million square feet of underground tunnels around Berlin, all dug by slaves. With this experience, Ricke had become a veteran negotiator between private industry and the SS Business Administration Main Office in the procurement of slaves. The SS began, in effect, a rent-a-slave service to firms and government enterprises at a typical rate of 4 marks a day for unskilled workers and 6 marks for skilled ones, writes V-Weapon historian Michael J. Neufeld. The slaves were disposable. When they died, they were replaced. At Nordhausen, the SS gave Ricke a discount, charging the middlework between 2 and 3 Reichsmarks per man per day. On May 6, 1944, days after becoming general manager of the middlework, Rike called a meeting to discuss how best to acquire more prisoners for slave labor. Werner von Braun, Walter Dornberger, and Arthur Rudolph were all present. It was decided that the SS should enslave another 1,800 skilled French workers to fill the shoes of those who had already been worked to death. The record indicates that von Braun, Dornberger, and Rudolph showed no objection to Riquet's plan. In August, the same problem was again at issue. This time, Werner von Braun initiated the action himself. On August 15, 1944, von Braun wrote a letter to a metalwork engineer, Albin Sawatsky, describing a new laboratory he wanted to set up inside the tunnels. Von Braun told Sawatsky that to expedite the process, he had taken it upon himself to procure the slave laborers from the Buchenwald concentration camp. "During my last visit to the metalwork, you proposed to me that we use the good technical education of detainees available to you from Buchenwald," wrote von Braun. "I immediately looked into your proposal by going to Buchenwald myself, together with Dr. Simon, a colleague, to seek out more qualified detainees. I have arranged their transfer to the metalwork with Standartenfuhrer, Colonel, Pister, the commandant of Buchenwald." In December of 1944, with slave laborers dying by the thousands in the metalwork tunnels and V-2 rockets crashing into civilian population centers causing mayhem and terror across Europe, it would have been hard to imagine that some of those directly responsible would ever be regarded as individuals of great value to the United States. And yet in less than a year, Arthur Rudolph, George Riquet, Werner von Braun, Major General Walter Dornberger, and other rocket engineers would secretly be heading to America to work. In the last days of World War II, few would have ever believed such a thing. But the war's last days were coming. Just 3 weeks after the celebration at Castle Varlar, Albert Speer found himself with a lot less to celebrate. Visiting the Belgian border town of Houffalize, accompanied by an SS Armored Force commander named Joseph Sepp Dietrich, Speer had what he would describe in his 1969 memoir as a realization. Gazing upon the bodies of hundreds of dead German soldiers killed in a recent Allied bomber attack, Speer decided the war was over for the Reich. The German war machine could no longer compete against the force and will of the Allied offensive. Howling and exploding bombs, clouds illuminated in red and yellow hues, droning motors, and no defense anywhere, I was stunned by this scene of military impotence which Hitler's military miscalculations had given such a grotesque setting, Speer wrote. Standing there in Houffalize, Speer, Hitler's Minister of Armaments and War Production, decided to flee from the danger zone. At 4 a.m. on the morning of December 31st, under cover of darkness, Speer and an aide climbed into a private car and hurried east, headed for the comforts of a sprawling mountaintop castle outside Frankfurt called Schloss Kronsberg, or Castle Kronsberg. Built on a steep, rocky cliff in the Taunus Mountains, the castle was one of Hermann Göring's Luftwaffe, German Air Force, headquarters. Just as many of Hitler's scientists would soon become American scientists, so would many of the Reich's headquarters and command posts become key facilities used for Project Paperclip. Castle Kronsberg also had a storied past in the history of warfare. The structure dated from the 11th century, but its original foundation had been built on top of the ruins of a ring wall fortification constructed in the time of the Roman Empire. Battles had been waged in this region on and off for over 2,000 years. Castle Kranzberg was grand and splendid, built piecemeal over the centuries to include watchtowers, half-timbered meeting halls, and stone walls. It had 150-odd rooms, including a wing that had been redesigned and renovated by Albert Speer in 1939 when Speer was still Hitler's architect. At Hitler's behest, Speer added several state-of-the-art defense features to Kranzberg Castle, including a 1,200-square-foot underground bunker complex, complete with poison gas airlocks designed to protect inhabitants from a chemical warfare attack. Now here was Speer, having fled from the front lines to hide out in this citadel. The next time he would live here, it would be as a prisoner of the Americans. Hitler had his own headquarters just a few miles away. Adlerhorst, or the Eagle's Nest, had also been designed by Speer. It was a series of small cement bunkers at the edge of a long stretch of valley near the spa town of Bad Nauheim. Few knew it was there. From Adlerhorst, Hitler had been directing the Ardennes campaign, the Battle of the Bulge. Arriving at Kranzberg Castle late at night, after fleeing Houffalize, Speer and his aide were shown to their quarters, where they freshened up before driving over to Adlerhorst to celebrate the coming year, 1945, with Hitler. When Speer arrived at the Eagle's Nest at 2:30 a.m. on January 1st, Hitler, who never drank, appeared drunk. "He was in the grip of a permanent euphoria," remembered Speer. Hitler made a toast and promised that the present low point in the war would soon be overcome. Hitler's magnetic gifts were still operative, Speer later recalled. In the end, Germany would be victorious, Hitler said. This was enough for Speer to change his mind about losing the war. 2 weeks later, on January 15th, with the war allegedly still winnable, Adolf Hitler boarded his armored train and began the 19-hour trip to Berlin, where he would spend the rest of his life living underground in the Führer bunker, Führerhauptquartier, or FHQ, in Berlin. The bunker was a fortress of engineering prowess, built beneath the new Reich Chancellery. Its roof, buried under several tons of earth, was 16 feet thick. Its walls were 6 feet wide. Living inside the Führer bunker, with its low ceilings and crypt-like corridors, was like being stranded in a cement submarine, said one of Hitler's SS honor guards, Captain Behrmann. Behrmann described a bat-like routine of part-time prisoners kept in a cave, miserable rats in a musty cement tomb in Berlin. Not everyone shared the sentiment. Months later, when Middlework general manager George Riquet was angling to get a job from the Americans, he would boast to the army officers that he'd overseen construction of the Grand Führer bunker in Berlin. Now, in mid-January 1945, with Hitler moving back to Berlin, it was decided that Speer should head east to Silesia in Poland. There he was to survey what was going on. Important chemical weapons factories had been built in Poland, armaments ventures jointly pursued with IG Farben, a chemical industry conglomerate. The location of these facilities was significant. Poland was, for the most part, out of reach of Allied bombing campaigns. But a new threat was bearing down. The Soviets had just launched their great offensive in Poland, a final military campaign that would take the Red Army all the way to Berlin. Germany was being invaded from both sides, east and west, squeezed as in a vise. The same day that Hitler left the Eagle's Nest, Speer was driven to Poland. There he witnessed firsthand what little was left of the Reich's war machine. On January 21st, he went to the village of Oplin to check in with Field Marshal Ferdinand Schorner, newly appointed commander of the Army Group, and learned that very little of the Wehrmacht's fighting forces remained intact. Nearly every soldier and every war machine had been captured or destroyed. Burnt-out tank holes littered the snow-covered roads. Thousands of dead German soldiers lay in ditches along the roadsides, but many more dead soldiers swung eerily from trees. Those who dared desert the German army had been killed by Field Marshal Schorner, a ferocious and fanatical Nazi Party loyalist who had earned his moniker, Schorner the Bloody. The dead German soldiers had placards hanging around their necks. "I am a deserter," they read. "I have declined to defend German women and children, and therefore I have been hanged." During Speer's meeting with Schorner, he was told that no one had any idea exactly how far the Red Army was from overtaking the very spot where they were standing, only that the onslaught was inevitable. Speer checked into an otherwise empty hotel and tried to sleep. For decades, this night remained vivid in Albert Speer's mind. "In my room hung an etching by Kate Kollwitz, La Carmagnole," remembered Speer as an old man. "It showed a yowling mob dancing with hate-contorted faces around a guillotine. Off to one side, a weeping woman cowered on the ground. The weird figures of the etching haunted my fitful sleep," wrote Speer. There, in his Oplin hotel room, Albert Speer was overcome by a thought that had to have been preoccupying many Nazis' minds. "After Germany, what will become of me? The guillotine? Will I be torn apart by a yowling mob? Jedem das Seine. Could it be true? Does everyone get what he deserves?" The following week, on January 30, 1945, Speer wrote a memorandum to Hitler outlining the huge losses in Silesia. "The war is lost," is how Speer's report began. Widespread destruction of evidence would now begin. Chapter 2. Destruction. 90 miles southeast of Speer's Oplin hotel room, chaos was unfolding at the Auschwitz-Birkenau death camp. Speer's chairman of the ultra-secret Committee C for Chemical Weapons, a chemist named Dr. Otto Ambrose, had documents to destroy. It was January 17, 1945, and every German in a position of power at Auschwitz, from the army officers to the IG Farben officials, was trying to flee. Not Ambrose. He would not leave the labor extermination camp for another 6 days. Otto Ambrose was a fastidious man. His calculations were exact, his words carefully chosen, his fingernails always manicured. He wore his hair neatly oiled and parted. In addition to being Hitler's favorite chemist, Ambrose was the manager of IG Farben's synthetic rubber and fuel factory at Auschwitz. With the Red Army bearing down, the Farben board members had ordered the destruction and removal of all classified paperwork. Ambrose and colleague Walter Dürrfeld were at Auschwitz to do the job. In addition to being the plant manager of this hellish place, Ambrose was the youngest member on Farben's board of directors. All over the camp, SS guards were destroying evidence. Crematoria 2 and 3 were being dismantled, and a plan to dynamite Crematoria 5 was in effect. Some of the SS officers were already fleeing on horseback, while others were preparing to evacuate prisoners for the death march. Whips cracked, dogs barked, tanks painted white for camouflage outside the camp rolled through the muddy streets. Rumors swirled. The Red Army was only a few miles away. A female chemist in Farben's Bühnewerk polymerization department asked the prisoner and future world-renowned writer Primo Levi, a chemist by training, to fix her bicycle tire. After the war, Levy recalled how strange it was to hear a Farben employee use the word please with a Jewish inmate like himself. Auschwitz was the Reich's largest extermination center. As a concentration camp, it consisted of three separate but symbiotic camps: Auschwitz I, the main camp, Auschwitz II, the Birkenau gas chambers and crematoria, and Auschwitz III, a labor concentration camp run by the chemical giant IG Farben. Since April 7, 1945,